Coming up next on Tech News Today, Facebook metrics for video have been inaccurate for 2 years. Oops. Also, almost everyone is swapping their Note for a Note, according to Samsung. Apple's home appliance with Siri might have facial recognition. Google and Salesforce are but two companies that are interested in a buyout of Twitter. And Res Infinite will turn your PlayStation VR into the best rave in the world. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1605, recorded Friday, September 23rd, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more.
And by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/twit.
And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at QuickenLoans.com/TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. This is a show where we talk about all the technology that matters, and we are the peanut butter and jelly of tech news.
I was going to say we're the gray and gray.
I was going to say that we're the gray and gray or the two shades of gray, but I didn't really think shades of gray was appropriate.
Probably, maybe steer away from that.
I said it.
That's so. Okay. But to explain, apparently I spell gray G-R-A-Y, and do you spell it G-R-E-Y?
Well, that was what I was trying to figure out by searching my Google, my email, but I think I do both, but I think actually A-Y is what I'm more comfortable with.
I'm really impressed because we got into this little debate before the show, and then probably about like 10 seconds later, Megan's like, actually, you say G-R-A-Y. Apparently, I said that at some point in an email. You were able to find it.
Yes.
More importantly, so.
I would like to live in a world where all of our conversations are recorded somewhere and searchable so that I can, you know, win arguments. That sort of thing.
I'm cool with these conversations being recorded.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of what we do here.
Yeah, exactly. We should do that. We should do what we do.
All right. Let's do what we do. Video is on a tremendous tear online, and platforms like Facebook have tempted advertisers with video ads based on metrics that prove just how popular their video ad platform is. But as it turns out, metrics are hard, such as the case with news today that Facebook's estimated average video viewing time was inflated 60 to 80% for the past 2 years, according to sources at the Wall Street Journal. This information was instrumental in the decisions of ad buyers and marketers all over the place, because everybody's advertising on Facebook these days. Now these marketers are upset, to say the least. I mean, basically, they made a lot of choices on ad spending. We're talking lots and lots of dollars were, you know, shifted back and forth based on metrics that Facebook says, you know, all of these eyeballs are seeing these. Apparently, those metrics are incorrect.
Well, look at it this way. I mean, my dad was an ad man in, you know, the 70s in New York. Like, they had no metrics. They had no idea who was looking at when and what and how long. And then they had Nielsen. And Nielsen is okay. It's an aggregate. But I think what they're upset about is that it's not an independent third party. Like, Nielsen is an independent third party. But Facebook is saying, hey, we know how long people are looking at our videos, and here are these numbers. And no one was really checking that.
Yeah. So, I mean, the big challenge, of course, is that these are technology companies, and technology companies like to hold a lot of stuff close to the vest. They don't want total release of every single piece of information, piece of data, and all that kind of stuff. A lot of it's proprietary behind the scenes stuff that only they want control over. So I don't know if this sort of thing calls for the need for a third party in this particular sphere of online advertising, let's say, compared to what you're talking about. Maybe it is something that advertisers should be pushing more for.
Well, Nielsen still exists. They still exist for online ads, and so they may become more popular. popular after this news. I mean, this is a big deal. Facebook's stock went down today. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, they are running the ad business at this point. And for them to come out and say, oh, yeah, it's been several years that we've been, you know, miscalculating this. It's, I feel like all week it's just like a liar, liar, pants on fire situation for tech news. It's like Yahoo, like, yeah, we knew for a few years that, you know, some state actor had your information. Like, who can you believe these days?
Yeah, although, you know, I just saw this right before we came to the show and we didn't have time to kind of write it in. But apparently Yahoo found out about this. At least according to a source, the Financial Times found out about it in July. So they didn't potentially know about it as long as some people were guessing in that case. But it's still, you know, yeah, this kind of stuff is hard. Facebook, at least, they apologized. There's that, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's good enough. But basically, they said the metric should have reflected the total time spent watching a video divided by the total number of people who played the video. But it didn't. They insist that this is, only one important metric to consider out of many, and that the error didn't affect billing, and that they've made a change. They made the change, so it's all better now.
Mm-hmm. Facebook, it's too late to say sorry. Well, here's something else that I don't know whether to believe or not. Samsung says that of the 500,000 Galaxy Note 7s that have been returned, 90% of customers have opted to replace them with another, less likely to set fire to their house, Galaxy Note 7. So another phone, the new ones, they want another Galaxy Note 7. Now, Samsung did not say whether or not any of those 90% were the 92 people who reported the batteries overheating, or the 26 people reporting burns, or the 55 people reporting property damages. Half of the recalled devices are still out there. One of them belongs to Lawrence, who, despite I did my best to Twitter shame him. That usually works. But he has not yet replaced his. He claims he's going tomorrow, maybe, because he says he still likes the idea that any minute his phone might explode in his hand.
He's one of those. Mm-hmm. One of those people. It's like, well, it's kind of cool.
Well, to his credit, he tried. He went in last week. They would not take it back. Because he's not the primary. He's like grandfathered in on his parents' plan. Oh. And his parents were out of town. So he went in and they were like, we won't take it. And
good work, Lawrence.
Yeah, I know. And when I Twitter shamed him, you know, Flo from All About Android, she got in on there. She said if he has not exchanged it by Wednesday or Tuesday when she comes in, she's going to.
Mm-hmm.
Don't want to mess with Flo.
She'll follow through with that, too. So you want to be careful. Yeah, so let's see here. 50% have returned so far. That's up from 25% on Tuesday. So that's pretty good. I had started this process a couple of weeks ago when I called, and then I heard absolutely nothing. And I think this is kind of further indication of kind of the mishap in Samsung going too soon with the whole return process before the official kind of process was played out. I got an email a couple of days ago, or no, actually yesterday, that that basically I had to go to their site, a new page on their site, and enter in my order number and the email address that it's associated with, and then through that interface, I was able to select what I wanted to do. Do I want a replacement note? If so, what color? Or do I want one of the other phones? Or get a full refund? So I did that, and at the end of that process, they said I should see a replacement device in 2 to 3 business days.
Mm.
So I still had to do it two times. Like, it's almost as if that call never happened, even though they said you've done what you need to do. We'll send you something soon. Maybe this was the something that they were sending me soon.
Right. And all the while you weren't depending on it. Like Lawrence,
right,
and others,
I mean, that's
their
difference.
Only phone, you know, so they can't, mm-hmm. Do that. So.
Mm-hmm. And you thought the music streaming space was already competitive. Clear Channel's iHeartRadio is about to make major changes in January 2017 with new iHeartRadio Plus and All Access plans. The latter is a full-service on-demand music subscription service with licensing agreements signed with Warner Music Group, Sony Music Group, and Universal Music Group, along with a bunch of indie label offerings. The Plus plan will allow users who listen to the radio and hear a song that they like, those users can save that song to their own playlists and instantly repeat it with unlimited song skips. So it kind of reminds me a little bit of kind of Pandora's offering on their Is that also a plus? Pandora Plus, I think
it's called. Yeah, it's called Pandora Plus also. That's $5 a month.
Interesting. They're all doing the same thing.
I know. They didn't really say how much this was going to cost. I mean, I guess you found that the New York Post said it was going to be $5 a month.
Yeah, New York Post said $5 a month for Plus, $10 a month for All Access, which kind of falls in line with traditional planning or, you know, pricing at this point. But yeah, they're kind of building upon the radio features of the service that kind of set iHeartRadio apart to bring it closer to what people expect from traditional streaming services. I don't know if it's too late to the game, but they've got a decent amount of users, 90 million registered users, 250 million listeners total. So, yeah, we'll see how it goes for them.
Mm-hmm. I would like to think it's not too late to the game as well, but I think perhaps it is.
I think it might just be. Yeah.
I mean, when are we going to just accept that there's Windows computers and there's Mac computers and there's Linux computers and we're not like waiting for something else to come along? You know, yeah. It's like it's Spotify and Apple Music and Tidal or Tidal and Apple Music. Who knows what it's going to be, but, you know.
The trick isn't that it's bad having choice. Like, consumers love having choice and having all sorts of options. That's great. The problem is, when it comes to streaming music, it's already hard enough to make music or make money with streaming music services online. So when you've got all of these different services, as a user, I know that only a certain number of those are actually going to last a long time. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And some of them are just not going to last, probably. This is just not going to make sense in the long term financially.
Right. They're fixed costs that people can't get around. Like, mm-hmm. you know, the record companies aren't going to break, you know, give deals to our iHeartRadio just because, you know, they're new and they like them. You know,
right.
It's going to be the same cost for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Apple has yet to iron out all the kinks in its launch of iOS 10 on the iPhone 7. Earlier this week, a ton of people were reporting problems with their Lightning port dongle that comes in the box, including the fact that it times out and you can't use the volume controls on the earpods. Those are the wired ones, not the fancy-looking AirPods, Bluetooth AirPods. Today, Apple released iOS 10.0.2 to fix these issues. Now, the timing out issue included one fun quirk that made it impossible to answer the phone if someone was calling you.
That's my favorites.
I know. It's like some people actually use these little handheld Facebook machines as phones, and they want to use them to call and answer phone calls, and you couldn't. But if you download the update, you can.
Good. Man, the long national nightmare is over.
I know. And, the plus side of this is, like, because it's Apple, it was a bug. It got reported. Yeah. Everybody gets the fix.
Right, exactly.
You know, as
that's
opposed to having to wait for it to roll out.
Mm-hmm. That's the strength right there. And that's, you know, I long for that type of support in the Android world. Who knows if that'll ever happen as widespread as it does in the Apple world. Sources is kind of along the Apple train here. Sources tell Mark Gurman and Ian King of Bloomberg that Apple is moving forward with plans to bring Siri to the home in different ways. Sure, the Apple TV has somewhat kind of bridged that gap recently. But in this case, Apple is testing an appliance along the lines of Amazon Echo or a Google Home. The device would act as a hub for smart appliance controls. It would include advanced microphone and speaker technology. The report says that would set itself apart from its competitors. I'm very curious to see how that works. Some testing has also included the use of facial recognition technology. I think that's that component right there, or some sort of identity verification, is really, I don't know, you're the owner of an Echo, so you tell me, but I feel like that's kind of essential for this to work long term. From what I understand from the Google I/O announcement on Google Home is that when this releases, maybe plans have changed between then and the beginning of October when this is going to be announced officially, but when it launches, you'll only be able to tie it to one account, right? So if you've got two or three people in the household that all have Google accounts that want to know what their next appointment is or whatever the thing is, it's only going to be synced to one account initially. And the problem there, of course, is verification. How does it know that you are who you are versus you and somebody else in the household? So I think if Apple is tackling this and really kind of making verification of identity a priority, I think that's a big deal.
Yeah, so how would that work, the facial recognition? Is that right? Do you think it's like something built into your wall? Like you walk up and tell me my appointments, please.
Yeah, I don't know how it works. Facial recognition kind of seems a little out there, right? Like, unless you're standing in front of the Apple appliance, whatever they want to call it, the Siri Home or whatever they're going to end up calling it. I almost wonder if like some sort of voice identification, voice characteristic identification would make more sense because you're using your voice for the actions. But I think that's really smart. I'm very curious to see if that actually ends up in a final product, if and when that happens.
I mean, whatever they do, it has to be better than the Amazon Echo, and it has to be better than the Google Home, especially the Amazon Echo, because we already basically have, you know, we have Siri in our phones. We, you know, now almost every family member has their own phone, so it's already tied to their account. It's, you know, we bring it wherever. You know, so it has to have a better speaker. It has to have, you know, facial recognition software. We've talked about this before. Maybe it'll be part of the Apple TV. That's been something, you know, a suggestion that you know, controls your whole home that way. And, you know, it's connected because it's already connected to your phone. You can also use it when you're not at home. So, you know, you control, you turn your lights off when you're somewhere else. And I mean, I do think that Apple has been working with home automation for a long time. It's still not easy. It's a little bit easier with iOS 10, but it's not easy enough for me to spend the time, you know, setting up how to turn my lights on and off. It's way easier for me just to turn them off and on.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It's like you spend all sorts of hours to save yourself minutes. You know what I mean? That doesn't make a lot of sense in the long run. At the same time, I mean, is this kind of an area that Apple could be the next big, let's say, focus for them? I realize they've been working on HomeKit and this sort of stuff for a while now, but I feel like having an appliance to control it seems like the obvious like way that you take it to the next step, you know, having this single hub that you just, you'd talk to, as opposed to having to pull out your phone and monkey around with it in order to get your lights to turn off. If it ends up becoming as easy as Siri, turn the lights off or whatever, and just that appliance that happens to be in the room. Like, I feel like that's the component that takes this from an interesting thing that Apple's doing and into, this is the next must-have thing for your house. You know, if you're in the Apple ecosystem, you need to get this.
I wonder how many people's lights you just turned off.
Sorry. That was a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, besides the Apple Watch, Apple hasn't come out with any piece of original hardware. There's been a newer, you know, Apple TV since then, but that already existed. It's just a new version. So it'd be great if they came out with this. I think, I mean, I wonder about the lackluster response to the Apple Watch, whether they're really waiting. You know, they say they've been working on this for 2 years before the Echo came out. So maybe they are really waiting for this magnificent thing that's going to come out. I hope so.
Mm-hmm.
After the break, Sam Moscovich tells us why one video game brought him to tears. But first, let's take a minute to thank Epson, the sponsor of this episode. Epson's revolutionary cartridge-free EcoTank line of printers for home and office introduce a new age in printing. The EcoTank ET4550 wireless all-in-one printer doesn't use ink cartridges. It features an amazing, innovative, refillable ink tank, earning it the title of CES 2016 Innovation Awards honoree. No more out-of-ink frustration. It includes up to 2 years of ink. That's equal to 11,000 black pages or 8,500 color pages. That's a long time not to have to replace your ink. That's awesome. You can also save up to 80% on ink with low-cost replacement bottles. It's powered by Precision Core printing technology. It has auto two-sided printing and 30-page auto document feeder. Easy wireless printing from your tablet and any of your smartphones. All EcoTank printers deliver an unbeatable combination of convenience and value. With Epson's EcoTank line of printers, you'll have the freedom to print without running out of ink. The Epson EcoTank system was named the 2016 Small Biz Windows Printer of the Year. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank today to transform the way your home, office, or workgroup prints. For the best combination of ease and value, turn to the Epson EcoTank printer. That's EPSON.com/EcoTank, and we thank Epson for their support. It's time for this week's gaming check-in with Sam Moscovich from Ars Technica. Welcome, Sam.
Good Friday to everybody. Hello, hello.
Well, we hear that the PlayStation VR game Res Infinite made you cry, and you're not ashamed to talk about it, so talk about it.
Well, is this going to be Tender Feelings Friday? Is that
it
how
is
we're doing
Tender
this?
Tender Feelings Friday, yes.
I think we even have some graphical transitions with like hearts and tears to go.
I'm never coming on again if you guys are going to really bully me for being a fully fledged emotional adult.
This is our Barbara Walters moment right
but
here.
But I will say, you know, if you are as cold-hearted as my good friends here at twit.tv and you need a video game that brings you back to that real emotional center that you've lost after watching all of this tech programming, Res Infinite might be the trippy sci-fi cyberpunk whirly-girly adventure for you. As anyone who's watched the show over the past year and a half knows, who's seen me go on and on about virtual reality content, I'm pretty crazy about strapping on a headset and trying out a trippy, weird experience. But I can understand that there's hesitation and reluctance for people to put something on their head that warps them around, makes them see a bunch of trippy stuff. It can sound very intense, but Res Infinite, I think, is one of those incredible experiences that anybody who has the slightest inclination about technology, and when I say that, I mean anybody who had joy grabbing that Wii remote for the very first time and playing Wii bowling with their mom or something, they owe it to themselves when the PlayStation VR kit comes out, assuming they can get their hands on it since it's going to be limited, to try Res Infinite. Res was a game that came out in the year 2001 on the Dreamcast, and then again 2002 on PlayStation 2, since no one had the Dreamcast. And it was this incredibly strange rhythm adventure game. Now, remember, rhythm gaming at the time was such a curio of the gaming world, as in Parappa the Rappa,
oh, yes.
Dance Dance Revolution, these games that gamers know about and that non-gamers like make fun of. And this sort of came at that same time. It was actually created, the creator, Tetsuya Mizuguchi, I'm so sorry, I always blank on his name. Tetsuya-san, he created this after going to a rave. He was making games for Sega, went to Germany for some sort of event, went to a rave, and tripped out, couldn't believe what it was like, and said, I want to make a video game like this. However, the game in 2001 didn't quite work. It clearly was playable, but you had to use this joystick system to move your head around in the game and point at all these weird things, and it just didn't quite work in terms of creating this sort of rave-like experience that he was going on about. Well, Res VR essentially says, okay, now you're in this trippy world, but you simply look at things in trippy space and use a controller at that point to interact. And it's hard to explain why it works so well, other than to say the combination of light, sound, and motion is very seamless once you have VR. When you use your head instead of a controller, when you are actually looking at this thing that's sort of exciting you, all of the synesthesia stuff kicks into gear. Now, I've gotten to play it a few times, and this week I got to finally talk about the very final bit of the game called Area X, which was made newly for this system. Everything else in the game is from the original 2001 version, and now they've taken modern technology and said, what would this 2001 game play like if it was made now? The original game actually still holds up very well. It uses this sort of Tron-like wireframe style. And it just feels really cool to see everything in the universe essentially be made of stars, is the short way of putting it. You're floating around. Everything kind of looks like a bunch of stars coming together, pulsing in, pulsing out. All these tiny, tiny particles and dots and explosive effects coming together to create this trippy stuff that you fly around and interact with. Again, when you look at or aim at things in this game, in this virtual reality experience, it creates sound and light. So as you trigger stuff and shoot at it, it adds to the EDM music that is playing. I know I'm kind of rambling here, but it was really cool to be sitting in the same room as the creator and then talk to him about it. The crying part I mentioned, because it has this sort of emotional wordless story that plays out as you do it. And there's also this really intense feeling of, I'm really doing this. It really feels like I'm part of this incredible scene. And I explained this sort of intense feeling to its creator. And he responded that he said, you know, I cry all the time. He was talking about showing this game to people for the first time ever after months and months of working on it just in his own studio. And it was just one of these very bizarre hotel lobby video game expo moments for me. This was at PAX West for a few weeks ago. And I just found myself going up to him and giving him a big hug. It was kind of awesome. So what I then said in my article was, even if you don't get to sit with this guy and hug him, it really does feel like a full emotional experience, the kind of thing where this man is handing you a game experience and saying, this is like us hugging, like us having this emotional sharing. I don't mean for that to sound creepy. Please understand. That is just cool. I feel like I've just been talking and talking without you guys interrupting. I could really keep going about this game, but I really do enjoy it, and it comes out in October.
It's really, I mean, honestly, what you're talking about with this game is kind of what has kind of stoked my interest in VR, this kind of transportation to another world that goes beyond just looking at a screen on a wall, but rather kind of brings you into the experience. It sound, and I didn't have the chance to play the game when it was on Dreamcast. I thought Dreamcast was a great platform, by the way. But I didn't get a chance to play it back then. But I can imagine the amount of time between then and now and what you can do with this entirely new medium, you know, inside of a goggle. I mean, I hope that we will see more situations like this where it's not just kind of a video game that you play. And sure, yeah, it's cool to be surrounded by it. But because it breaks through an additional wall, you end up with this extra layer of emotion that makes the game that much more special.
There was something about it. I remember back in the day, people said, this game is ahead of its time. And right. Here we are now finally matched with a thing that doesn't cost a zillion dollars. It's $399, it's pretty expensive VR, yeah. But it is now its time. We are 15 years later. It is the time for a trippy, weird experience like this that does make sense for moving your head around. I don't like gimmicks. I like VR. If you're going to use your head, make it really make sense. Don't make it hurt. Don't make me dizzy. It's very comfortable. It's very exciting to play. It feels awesome. And I know there's going to be a lot of kiosks with PlayStation VR because Sony wants people to care about this. Yeah. So as the weeks roll along, as this is out there, if you do get a chance to check it out, 5 minutes, just at the very least, 5 minutes of this game will be worth your time. So keep your eyes out at malls, at stores, wherever you might possibly see PlayStation VR in the coming weeks.
Cool. All right.
Res Infinite. Okay, let's move on. Earlier this week, we talked about the departure of Blizzard Entertainment Chief Creative Officer Rob Pardo. And now you're telling me that Blizzard's Battle.net is changing its name to Blizzard Tech. What in the World of Warcraft is going on here, Sam?
Oh, zug, zug. This is such a strange thing for Blizzard to do, but they made this announcement. They buried it in their World of Warcraft blog, and they explained that they were going to deprecate the term Battle.net. And the explanation was sort of funky to me because it talked about occasional confusion and inefficiencies related to having separate identities under which everything falls, saying that Blizzard and Battle.net were these separate things and saying that was confusing. However, that's 20 years ago that this service was named this. There was so much different time. When Activision came in and bought out Blizzard, they could have changed the name. But essentially, for the uninitiated, Battle.net was the very simple multiplayer connecting software that the original Diablo in 1996 used to connect players. It actually only ran on a single PC. People have actually admitted over the years that they just had this one PC handling all the Diablo adventure questers who wanted to team up together on the internet. And over time, it has evolved and changed, having its own standalone app. I can't remember exactly how many years ago that happened, but it used to be just this little thing in the corner of all the other individual games, and now it has its sort of overlying structure, and they've added other stuff to it. Blizzard Streaming, which is a Facebook plugin, so that when you're playing Blizzard games, you can just connect them to your Facebook Live feed. Blizzard Voice is this sort of cross-game voice over IP platform where friends can talk to each other from other games, so on and so forth. So now the company has decided, all right, we've got a bunch of different internet stuff on a bunch of different devices. We're on computers. We are on smartphones, thanks to Hearthstone. We are on consoles, thanks to the shooting game Overwatch. So I think, honestly, this was less about a name change and more about saying, we are on all the devices and we want to own eyeballs in a much more efficient way. While we're at it, we are going to probably have to change some of the apps and some of the things. So first off, here's a name name change. Now, the phrase Blizzard Tech, this was sort of confusing. The original blog post said, we're getting rid of Battle.net, we're going to unveil something called Blizzard Tech. Well, they updated the post and removed the phrase Blizzard Tech because everyone said, that name is stupid. So basically what they meant was that everything's just going to have, it's just going to be called Blizzard. But they're not being very clear. They didn't show off screens or exactly what to expect. So I don't know if they're going to have their own special iOS and Android app that's going to be called Blizzard Mobile, or if they're going to do something totally different on computer. It's sort of a confusing table setting for whatever's to come, but it makes sense that the things that they are printing money with, specifically Overwatch and Hearthstone, being outside of the PC space and getting those people's eyeballs towards the stuff that makes them money on PC, or in the case of World of Warcraft, doesn't make them as much money as it used to. It's sort of a strange, it's just sort of a bit of punctuation on what appears to be quite a transition period, especially with a lot of original old school executives, like the one you mentioned, not being at the company anymore. After 20 years, things change and teams change and major leadership changes. And Blizzard has done pretty well up to this point to not tarnish its name with a bunch of garbage or games that don't make sense. Basically, everything they've released has been solid. World of Warcraft, if anything, is too faithful to the original archetype of what people have loved and expected about that. So, you know, I don't think it's the end of Blizzard or doom and gloom, but I did love Battle.net as someone who was PC gaming in 1996 and really, really enjoying getting on other people's Diablo feeds and messing with their towns and slaughtering cows and all that stuff. So
it was you. It was you.
I did it. Okay. Now we know. I'm glad that 20 years later that my conscience can be clean. It's crying and confessions.
Yes. What's next?
Street Fighter.
Oh, okay.
Apparently, Street Fighter was asking for kernel access. They said that it was to prevent cheating. Now they're rolling it back. What's going on here?
Oh, my God. Street Fighter V has been a mess. This game launched in February, and at the time when I reviewed it, I said, cool game. Let me know when it's done. They hadn't got all the characters out. The online modes were weird. The internet login issues were weird. There was no single-player quest mode. And they were just like, nobody wants that. And users said, what are you talking about? We do like to be able to play by ourselves before we get our butts kicked on the internet. They've been updating it on a monthly basis, and some of these updates have been late and some have been a little underwhelming, but this was the big one because it's the final release in the season pass. Now they're going to be doing essentially a thing where you never need to buy another Street Fighter, right? Street Fighter 6, that'll happen someday. But for Street Fighter 5, the idea is you don't have to buy like the Super Ultra Turbo Edition. The idea being that you keep this game and they just keep on adding characters and other little things. So they've got the final character, who's this gray-haired gentleman named Urien, who wears a thong if you hold down the right buttons. I'm not even kidding. It's thong time at Street Fighter. But what's getting people up in arms isn't the thong, it is the terrible access to your computer's kernel. As in, when you load Street Fighter V on Windows right now, you get a little pop-up message asking. Now, I'm talking about running the game, not just in an installation. It's asking for user account control, which is that Windows sort of prompt you've been getting since Windows Vista, saying, do you want this to be accessing your system files and System 32 folder and a lot of the sensitive stuff? And the reason being, the Street Fighter people said, we are cracking down on PC cheating, and this is not DRM. They actually specifically said not DRM. But then if you really go back and look at why Capcom and the Street Fighter people would want that access, it turns out all their public statements have been about players using little software tweaks to get through the grinding stuff. There's things in the game that you just require a lot of repetitive gameplay. But you can use a little trainer. It's the old term that PC gamers like to use for a little attached file that lets you speed through some of that kind of nonsense and unlock outfits and other little perks that you might otherwise either pay. You might pay to get them faster, or you can grind through the game really slowly and boringly. Capcom really called that out a while back. Issued a couple of stern warnings in the past few months. And so here we are with what is really, really intense DRM. It was that case. Now, Capcom saw a lot of people come up in arms about this, in part because this update broke the game for a lot of computer users. Turns out, if you had the game installed in certain directories on your computer that Street Fighter and Capcom did not expect you to do, it would just not work, because apparently Capcom only has about 7 people playing the computer version in their testing lab or something ridiculous like that. So between that issue and people raging, Capcom said, all right, you know what? We're going to undo all of this. Stay tuned. We'll let you know soon. I've never seen I was talking to coworkers about this. I haven't seen a PC video game ever do this in terms of saying, oh, we need to lock down cheating or lock down other stuff. And the reason being, most PC games, when it comes to these sorts of microtransactions, they use a system like Steam or on consoles, something like PlayStation Network or Xbox Live, which has totally verifiable purchases. You can have those systems run checks on whether or not stuff has been purchased and unlock it accordingly. Capcom wanted to save a little bit of money and kept all of that stuff in-house and tried to build their own account system, which, by the way, if your copy of Street Fighter V crashes and deletes itself for any reason, you have to go back and re-earn all the crap in the game. It's still kind of broken. So this is what happens when you see other people cheating their way to breaking your own currency, and you say the solution is not to fix your currency, but to invade your users' computers. I think it's one of the lowest, dirtiest, most scoundrel moves I've ever seen from a PC game maker. I think it sucks. I'm really glad they turned that around. And I think they should be ashamed for putting that on any user's computer. The kind of invasive stuff that you can do, if you're just having a game executable do that, how easily someone else can go in and take access, just somehow, just little web browser hacks where they could redirect, knowing, oh, you have this EXE. I know that, and boop, 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 now I have control of your computer. That's terrible. That sucks. I'm mad. I'm furious. Can you see? I've gone from crying to confessing to shouting.
Wow, we moved through all the stages.
All the
today.
Feelings. We had all the feelings from Sam. Thank you so much. Thanks, as always, for joining us. Sam Moscovich is at Ars Technica. He's a culture editor. He's at Sam Red on Twitter. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye, everybody. I'm a much happier man. I really appreciate this purging.
It's a cleansing moment.
You're
indeed.
Welcome.
See you later, Sam. All right. Thanks to Richard Williams, who wrote us about a developing story. And yeah, I'm really happy this is in here. He says, the Krebs on Security website reported the identity or the ID of the Israelis allegedly responsible for a series of DDoS attacks, and they were subsequently arrested. Since then, Brian Krebs's website has been intermittently down due to attacks of the same nature. Just checked in for news updates, and again, it appears down, but this time it seems to have been for 18 hours. And yes, it's true, Krebs had to take down his site. A reporter at Motherboard talked to Krebs, who said the attack was composed of a botnet of compromised devices. Akamai was hosting Krebs on security pro bono, but the cost of diverting the traffic was too much. They had to take it down. He's working on a solution to get it back up again. He said on Twitter, Prolexic said, the 665 gigabit per second attack that hit my site tonight is almost twice the size of the largest attack they've ever seen. And then he actually spoke to Ars Technica today about this, and kind of, you know, at the heart of this, of course, is censorship, right? Mm-hmm. We don't like what you said. We don't like what you've reported. So we want to quiet you, essentially. And he says, it's hard to imagine a stronger form of censorship than these DDoS attacks, because if nobody wants to take you on, then that's pretty effective censorship. I've had a couple of big companies offer and then think better of offering to help me, because they would end up in the same position that Akamai ended up in. He says that's been very frustrating. So there you go. It's really kind of a disheartening scenario for someone who does a lot of really important reporting.
Absolutely. I mean, he told Motherboard, like, I'm plutonium right now. And it's, you know, it is interesting because we talk a lot about how, you know, women are silenced on Twitter sometimes just by like that sort of verbal attacks. And they're just like, well, fine, I'm going to go off Twitter. And people say, well, you don't have to be on Twitter. But it's like, that's a form of silencing. This is another form of silencing people. And you don't think about it all the time. But yeah, I mean, he's coming out, he's saying things that some regular journalists aren't saying. I mean, I go to Krebs on Security. That's where I check for stories. So I hope that he gets back up. I think he will. But this is troubling.
Yeah, and intense. Coming up, we've wondered if or when Twitter would consider itself on the market for an acquisition, and now apparently there's interest. We'll talk about that. But first, let's take a minute to thank ZipRecruiter. They are the sponsor of this episode. Are you hiring? I'm asking you. Yeah, you. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? I didn't think so. Posting jobs in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. And if you want to find the perfect hire, you're going to need to post your job on all the top job sites. And that can be challenging. Now you can do that pretty easily, though. We've got ZipRecruiter.com. You can post to more than 100 job boards, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. You just post one time, and then you'll see all those candidates are going to roll into the ZipRecruiter interface, super easy to use, really easy to understand and see and judge and all that kind of stuff. You can search by skills, location, work experience, and more. ZipRecruiter's advanced matching technology delivers the most relevant candidates based on your specific criteria. ZipRecruiter offers optimized pages. Those are going to look great on any screen. You can add their unique mobile apply process for more visitors and more applicants. You can find candidates in any city or industry nationwide, all over the place. No more juggling emails or calls to your office. You can also add multiple users to your account for management. And you can find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 1 million businesses and is trusted by hundreds of Fortune 500 companies. More than 125 million candidate applications have been delivered. And, you know, if you want to get in on the action, whether you're hiring now or plan to hire in the near future, check out their blog for recruiting tips and hiring resources. You'll learn a lot. Right now, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/twit. ZipRecruiter is the fastest way to hire great people. So go to ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. All right. Twitter has tried and tried again to go it alone, and it's encountered numerous roadblocks along the way. So a buyout has seemed more and more believable, possibly inevitable. Joining us to talk about some possible suitors this time around is Kurt Wagner from Recode. How's it going, Kurt?
Hey, what's up, guys? Happy Friday.
Yes, very happy indeed. Although I'm sure that those, I don't know, how do you think Twitter feels about this? You and Carl Swisher wrote an article last week breaking apart the pros and cons of something like this, the players in the space that might be interested in buying out Twitter. Were you surprised by today's news that Google and Salesforce might be in the running?
No, not at all. I mean, Google, we've heard for, a year probably, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe a little surprised about Salesforce, but they were mentioned in the list that we had laid out last week as all the possible suitors that we saw. So, no, I mean, I would have loved to not see it at 7 a.m. when my alarm went off and woke up to all the news, but can't say that I'm super surprised. This has been going on, as you guys know, for a really long time, and I'm sure while Twitter is sick of dealing with these stories, I mean, this is just what happens when you're a big public company that people care about and you're going through this kind of a process.
Yeah, so we've got Google, we've got Salesforce. I hadn't considered Salesforce, but the more I thought about it, the more I was like, okay, I guess I suppose that kind of makes sense. Do you think others are going to emerge at some point in this process? And if so, what would be some of those other options?
Sure, I do. I mean, I think if it comes down to Twitter basically making public or you know, making privately public that they're interested in selling, I think everyone, we listed about 10 or 12 different companies last week, and I think they all have valid reason to at least kick the tires and have an initial conversation. Certainly, you know, Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, I think there's, you know, Verizon, Comcast. I think there's a lot of people, and I'm not saying that all of these folks are going to make an offer or a bid or anything like that, but I just think that these are the kinds of companies that it's in their best interest to at least give Twitter a serious look. And I think it's obviously in Twitter's best interest to get as many people talking to them and bidding against one another as possible. So if it ultimately comes down to that, I would imagine we'll see something like we ended up seeing with LinkedIn, where they had, you know, five or six different people in the fold and ultimately created a bidding war between two or three of those folks. I'm sure Twitter would love that scenario if it came down to it.
So, I mean, you know, we've talked forever about the Yahoo sale, and Yahoo was a company that, you know, a lot of us just made fun of. In your article, you and Kara say that Twitter may be limping, but it's not lame. Can you talk a little bit about, like, what's the worth in Twitter? Like, why would people buy them?
Well, you think about what they offer. They offer pretty much, I guess, three, maybe four things. They do have, while it's not growing, they have a user base, right? 313 million active users, I believe. So that's big. They recently started doing this live streaming stuff, which people seem pretty thrilled about. They now stream two NFL games, including a number of other things that people probably don't care much about. But the NFL games have seemed to have gone well, and they're going to do the big debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump on Monday, which will be another chance to show that off. So they got users, they got this live streaming video capability, and then they have something that's really tough to measure, which is just simply cultural significance and influence, right? I mean, as much as we all dog on Twitter, is there a platform out there, maybe Facebook, but in a different way? Like, is there a platform out there that really can impact society the way that Twitter does, right? I mean, it's a place for breaking news, for changing the way that politicians think and the way that governments are run. And I think that there's like a social factor there that no other company really has. And again, it's tough to really measure that or provide a price tag for it. But I think that that certainly gives it some value. And I think there's a lot of people, especially people in the media world, would love to have someone like Twitter and Twitter's influence on their side.
Well, that cultural significance that you're talking about is so true, and we all can agree on that. But like, since when did that like bring in loads of money? I mean, we're asking a lot of Twitter. I mean, the stockholders are asking a lot. Like, I think of cultural significance like museums and like, you know, newspapers and stuff, and they're not rolling in the kind of money that people are expecting from Twitter.
Well, that brings us back to the ultimate issue, I think, for any of these companies buying Twitter is the price tag, right? I mean, Twitter can sit there all day and say, well, look at what we're able to do. I mean, we're able to, help overthrow suppressive governments. We're able to dictate the presidential election, right? I mean, like, we are doing some really powerful things, and yet, what does that mean, right? Like, does that translate to actual revenue? Some, sure, but that is the challenge right now, is how much do you pay for something that is socially or culturally significant, but still not necessarily a great business? And I don't know if there's a right answer. And I think that, you know, maybe it's going to take some kind of crazy billionaire, like, you know, when Bezos bought the Washington Post or whatever, like, maybe it's just going to take someone to say, listen, this is a cool trophy to have, and I'll try to figure out how to make it into a business. But for now, it's something that really matters. It's something that's kind of still hip, and I want to own it. And maybe that's a Mark Benioff. Maybe that's a Mark Zuckerberg. Who knows? But that's the real issue, right, is how do you put a price tag on that?
Yeah, it's kind of like Yahoo in the sense that Yahoo's been around long enough and established itself so much. And I think Twitter, you know, has kind of proven this over the years as well, that it's hard to imagine a reality where it doesn't exist to some form.
Totally.
What does it end up being? Who knows? Now, the sources on this pointed to a $30 billion magical number as the, you know, for this. You guys estimated more like $18 billion, so a little more than half. Why do you think such a big discrepancy between where you pegged it and where sources are saying it's coming in at?
Well, I think that when you're at this stage in a conversation, the last thing you want to do is put a number out there that seems low, right? So my guess is, you know, that people are speculating above probably where it's ultimately going to end up, because it's going to end up somewhere in the middle, right? I mean, I think if they were to sell for 18, I actually think that would be kind of great. You know, I think they're valued at, before today, I want to say they were valued at around 13. That's a pretty significant increase.
Sure.
For a company, again, that's not making money. So I think, you know, when people are talking and when Twitter goes out, the last thing they want to do is say, hey, we want 18, because they're going to get offers that are 16, right? Yeah. So I think if Twitter's having these conversations, certainly they're going to say, we want 30 and let's figure out what we go from there. I would be shocked if they sell for 30, but, you know, this whole thing has just been going on for such a long time, and I'm ready for it to be set and done. We'll see if anything happens. I know the CNBC report today said possibly by the end of the year. That to me would be a little quick. I thought maybe it might happen the first half of next year. But who knows? I mean, it really just depends. Once these conversations get going, they can pick up pretty quickly.
Yeah. So we spent a good part of this year discussing the lead up to the Yahoo sale. Now we'll spend the good part of the end of this year and part of next year talking about this with Twitter. Excellent.
Yes.
Nice to know that, at least.
Joy. Oh, joy.
Kurt Wagner with Recode. Where can people follow all your work online?
Yeah, thanks. You can follow me personally at KurtWagner8 on Twitter. You can follow all my work and the work of my colleagues at Recode.net. where you'll see a bunch of stuff about Twitter and other companies.
And other things. Thanks so much, Kurt. Thanks, always Kurt. A pleasure.
Thanks, guys. Have all a right. good weekend.
You too.
See ya. Yeah, you should, if you're interested in more about this, you should definitely read Kurt and Kara Swisher's articles.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
TNT's fan of the day is Catfish Billy on Twitter, who sent us this video saying this is how he generally watches TNT, technically listens.
Okay, he's not driving necessarily. He's parked, right? Yes? I think. Okay, good work.
He says, thanks goodness for the downloads. Thanks for keeping me entertained at work. You're welcome, Catfish Billy. I love checking out everyone's Twitter, too. I scrolled through a little bit of Catfish Billy's tweets. Entertained me for a while. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT, and we will find it, and I will stalk your Twitter. So just be prepared just a little bit. That.
It's public record, kind
right.
of. Sort.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not okay. stalking. Really. We all want internet to blanket our homes, right? Google wants to help us, but we will talk about that in a minute. First, let's thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, the sponsor of this episode. If you've ever gotten a mortgage, you know it's a huge, outdated hassle with lots of signing on old-fashioned paper. Plus, you have to leave the house. You don't want to leave the house. You might miss our show. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage approval process into the 21st century. It's fast, it's powerful, and it's completely online. Rocket Mortgage has taken all the complicated, time-consuming parts of applying for a mortgage out of the equation. With Rocket Mortgage, you can easily share your bank statements and pay stubs at the touch of a button, helping you get approved in minutes for a custom mortgage solution that's been tailored to your unique financial situation. Even better, with Rocket Mortgage, you can do all of this on your phone or your tablet. It's a quick online process that you can manage from the convenience of your couch. So, if you're looking to refinance your mortgage or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/TNT. That's quickenloans.com/TNT. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support.
All right, let's throw something new into the mix for Google's October 4th hardware announcement. I'm getting giddy at this point. We keep hearing more. Android Police is certain, based on multiple sources, that Google will unveil a new Wi-Fi router called Google Wi-Fi at the event with a cost around $129. What you see in this image, that's nothing.
That's garbage.
Here's an image that tells you router, but that isn't even what it'll look like.
What we used to think a router
was. Yeah, that's old school router. The router will tout some smart features, which I'm guessing would be the Google branded bridge that ties its upcoming Google Home appliance together with your home. Not to mention, this wouldn't be Google's first router outing after its higher priced OnHub router. That released, I think, earlier this year or mm-hmm. late last year. Especially when you consider that this router is expected to be linkable to other Google Wi-Fi access points, meaning improved Wi-Fi throughout the home, one large interconnected wireless network, which my home very desperately needs. So
yeah, we all want it to just blanket us all the time wherever
Blanketed.
We are. Blankets of Wi-Fi.
The warmth of Wi-Fi.
We'll never leave our house. I don't care where you get it from, just blanket me with Wi-Fi.
Sources are claiming that it's going to be like a little compact thing, kind of like the Amazon Echo Dot. So I suppose we'll see. Also apparently have a price on the 4K Chromecast Ultra. The sources say that'll be priced at around $69. So lots more hardware. Looking forward to it. Because the OnHub always seemed like just a little too much. So I like the idea of this maybe more scaled down general purpose Wi-Fi router for your home.
Like too much money or just too much Wi-Fi? Yeah, Can there be too much Wi-Fi?
No, I think like it's big and I don't know necessarily why I feel like OnHub hasn't really justified why it exists yet.
Yeah, you know? I don't really know many people who have it I think
it seemed when it first came out that it was going to be this great hub for home, automation and IoT and all that kind of stuff. But we haven't really seen a whole lot of that. It's just kind of a router for the mm-hmm. most part. So I don't know. Maybe once Google Home comes out, then it lights up, you know, and we suddenly realize exactly what the plan was all along.
Right. Maybe they were just trying to see if people would want a Google device in their homes all the time. Because that was the big deal. Like, we're like, well, okay, it's just a router, but it has no microphone. It has no speaker. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a lot of people said it doesn't because people wouldn't want Google. Like, they wouldn't want a Google speaker and microphone in their house.
And that was a year ago. Yeah. And now, where are we? Mm-hmm. Suddenly, that's what people want, apparently. Mm-hmm. All over the map, not just Google either, Amazon, Apple, all over. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can always be a part of the show. Just email us at tnt@twit.tv. You can leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW, and you can find us on Twitter. We're at Tech News Today TV.
If you are not already subscribed to the show, go subscribe. Go to twit.tv/TNT. Find all the ways to subscribe. And if you want to tell me how I can blanket my home with Wi-Fi, do that on Twitter. I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to our technical director, Kara. Thanks to Mario. Thanks to Kevin. Thanks to you. Thanks to...
Thanks to Lawrence for exchanging his Samsung
well, once
Galaxy
that
Note.
Happens, thanks to Lawrence.
Maybe we can thank him and guilt him into it.
Yeah, we've thanked you already, so you better be done with it already, Lawrence. seriously, thanks for watching, and we'll see you all on Monday. Bye, everyone.